Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and the production of the AS21 Podcast Network. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
How do you recommend people choose what they read?
Well, to some degree, of course, one would like to feel that they ought to follow their own nature. But these days, that leads to all kinds of difficulties. One cannot be happy about the 35 million copies of Harry Potter. I had a piece in today's Wall Street Journal.
I saw the editorial, yes, the op-ed piece.
Yes,
We can't be happy about that?
No, I think that's not reading, because there's nothing there to be read. They're just an endless string of clichés. I cannot think that that does anyone any good. I mean, people tell me, well, at least the child is reading, to which my answer is, no, the child isn't reading. That's not The Wind in the Willows. That's not Through the Looking Glass. That's not Charlotte's Web by E.B. White or James Thurber's The 13 Clocks. That's not really children's literature. It's really just slop. And I do not think it does anyone any good at all.
Okay, but then what are you saying? I mean, are millions and millions and millions of people wrong?
I'm afraid so.
I almost forgot, dear listener, we still need to return to our three critics, Harold Bloom, John Simon, and Clive James. Let's begin with the easiest of these three to tackle, and the first to be deceased. Easy because he was such an intellectual caricature. His persona to the world was so over the top that he was almost a popular culture figure of fun. With his physical shape, it's amazing that Harold Bloom made it past 60. And for the last 30 years, his physical appearance morphed into the embodiments of a desiccated, senile aesthetic. In so many ways, Harold Bloom was his own worst argument. 15 years ago, he was Me Too'd by Naomi Wolf, of all people. Given the lack of other women who came forward, I suppose it's possible that this was a one-off lapse in judgment, and given Naomi Wolf's long history of intellectual sloppiness and outright mental delusion, she might have interpreted Harold Bloom's intentions towards her as well, though I frankly doubt it. After he died, I half expected that every major magazine, such as they still exist, would fill their entire back halves with a dozen other Me Too stories about America's most powerful English teacher, and his most fawning students would pretend to be shocked by the extent of it. The truth is that Bloom long had a reputation for hitting on his students. But nevertheless, it's still possible, albeit unlikely, that Naomi Wolf misinterpreted him, and that all his other dalliances were both entirely consensual and without quid pro quo understandings of the power he would wield to their benefit. But even if Bloom was a saint, unlikely as that is, he was nevertheless a pope from which his church seceded, a living embodiment of apolitical aesthetic worship. That immersion in the greatness of literature was its own reward. His church had hardly any new saints, and inclusion in the church's canon practically ended with Samuel Beckett, a modernist update of the old saints. He would strongly praise a couple later writers, José Saramago, Philip Roth, Thomas Pynchon, and, of course, Tony Kushner, who was an ex-student of Bloom's and counted Bloom an influence on his work. Profiles in major magazines were often by former students who clearly earned his favor and bordered closely on the hagiographic. But as with all biographies of preacher saints, they were vague on the essential question. What did he actually teach? In his long dotage, Bloom was not really a teacher or a thinker. He was a religious cleric, a preacher of literature's church in a revival tent. And by the time I came of age as a reader, the extent of his literary output was staggering, but it was just book after book of literary cheerleading. When he was a young man, Bloom clearly had ideas. Everybody who's dipped a couple toes into literary theory knows the anxiety of influence, the thesis that great poets wrestle with their greatest predecessors in a kind of Freudian struggle to declare independence and individuality from father figures. The idea both has some merit and is also a little ridiculous. Everybody has predecessors, and great writers have to read in order to know how to write. So if you take it as a metaphor, I suppose it can yield all kinds of insight that helps you perceive how artists might have transformed the material of previous writers. But if you read it literally, it's also ridiculous. Inspiration comes from literally any facet of life, and we still have no idea how the brain conjures inspiration. His last truly original idea was probably surmising that the J writer, the writer of the largest and most consequential swath of the Old Testament, was none other than David's wife, Bathsheba, or Bathsheba. Why Bathsheba? Nobody could really figure out his reasoning. And yet, as Bloom never tired of admitting in one of his many self-contradictions, literary theory is itself ridiculous. No one in their right mind would read the theory behind a work you love when you can experience the work again. In that sense, Bloom was absolutely right. The point of the arts is not to be a tool to better understand politics or religion or ideology or sociology or systemic injustice or mythical archetypes. The point of art is to create something meaningful where nothing used to be. Once all the interpretations of theorists, both Christian and Marxist, expire, which Shakespeare and Mozart and Rembrandt inspire, the primary works still remain, with new interpretations for the concerns of new generations. Great works remain great, but our relation to it is always evolving. Artistic meaning can reside within all those fields of study, but attempts to pigeonhole art's purpose within the realm of those other fields make art a servant of propaganda. And this is a practice indulged in as often by right-wing intellectuals as it is by left-wing, all of whom Bloom loathed, and they loathed him back 77-fold. My contempt for Bloom was somewhat loving in spite of itself, and what I particularly admired was that he had all the right enemies. To be perfectly honest, I own more than half a dozen of his books, and I still occasionally dip into them, mostly for suggestions for other books to read, because it's not like I could make heads or tails of much of his writing. I'm not nearly as smart as I think I am. But for a reader who could read thousands of books in his memory, Bloom was a shockingly bad writer. His critical judgments were simultaneously imperious and incoherent. His tone both egotistical and self-pitying, and his prose only compelling when he hurled invective. I agreed with many of the insults, but it's a sad person indeed who likes another only for hating everybody you hate. Bloom mounted every defense for keeping the gates of higher art up as a critic could possibly mount. And by defending it so strenuously, he did as much as anyone to collapse the gate he claimed to defend. The question among intelligentsia used to be if it's a good use of one's time for a person who loves Dickens to read Bradbury and Tolkien. We now live in a world where the intelligentsia asks if it's a good use of one's time to read Dickens if you love X-Men.
You know, and are they, why do you think they believe and desperately want to get this book? I mean, they're being overwhelmed at Amazon.com.
Yes, I know, Charles. But a lot of that is fashion, of course. You know, a lot of that is...
You read it because somebody else is reading it, or you read it because you think it's a thing to do, or you read it because it's the current thing?
It is the current thing, yes. It is a fashion. It's a period piece, a whole series of period pieces. The history of reading is strewn with a vast dustbin of period pieces, and in 5 or 6 years, these will be period pieces also. They will be of interest to sociologists. They will not, the people who read them will not be able to remember what they read.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker, a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past. If you like this podcast, consider becoming a patron of the AS21 Podcast Network. Visit www.patreon.com/AS21 and donate today. Any amount will unlock special perks including bonus episodes and behind-the-scenes tidbits. That's patreon.com/AYS21.
Copyright 2019, AS21 Media, LLC, all rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?